Now, what I want to do today is talk a little bit about some tensions that I think that might arise for certain strategies of sort of egalitarian initiatives. Therefore, I think to give us some context to start off, I just want to sort of introduce one kind of example here. So I think we're all aware that there's quite a lot of issues, right, when it comes to representation in our discipline. So it's overwhelmingly white, lots of men, it's able-bodied, it's very middle class, and so on. So for some sort of concrete data on the issue, Helen Beebe and Jenny Soule have produced a report for the British Philosophical Association and the Society for Women in Philosophy UK in 2021. And they find that in comparison to their earlier sort of 2011 report, there have been some improvements at all levels, from sort of undergraduate up to full professorship. But there's, you know, we're not very close to gender parity, as you might be able to see on the slide. And they think it's going to take a very long time to get there. So what I want to suggest is that egalitarian initiatives that are seeking to address these sorts of issues to do with underrepresentation tend to share, or there's a very common strategy that they deploy, which involves drawing attention to the identities that are underrepresented. And I think there's like some good reasons for that. But what I want to focus on is this kind of second part of this thesis, which is that there's, you know, there's some sense in which that tactic can be unproductive in some senses. Sometimes those initiatives end up in some ways entrenching some of the issues that they fight against in virtue of adopting what I'm suggesting, at least in virtue of adopting the same sort of salient structure as the one that's embodied in the biases that they're fighting against. I will then sort of move to relatively briefly reflect on some kind of potential ways of responding to this, where I try and draw out you know, the underpinning salience-based goals we might have if we're working on behalf of these egalitarian initiatives, just to try and figure out the sort of space forward. So in terms of the plan for today, I'm going to start by looking a little bit closer at the problem of underrepresentation, and I'm going to draw on some tools in work that I've done before on the sort of philosophy of salience and attention. And I'm then going to sort of clarify a couple of different types of salience that I think are underpinning that discussion that sort of help us set up what is going to follow in the talk. Then I'll look at the kind of case study response, things like Women in Philosophy initiatives and sort of books that aim to reclaim women's voices. And I'll give a couple of examples, well, maybe one example for time reasons, that there's maybe a bit of a recurring issue that emerges. I'll then offer my diagnosis before we move on to the slightly more positive part. So I'm just going to start by sketching, as I say, that the problem of underrepresentation I want to focus on. There are many, right? But this is the one that I'm interested in here. So I'm going to draw on some anecdotes beyond those that come up just in philosophy, because they get quite neatly, I think, at the sort of issue that I want to drive at. So there's this pretty famous quote from artist Jean-Michel Basquiat, 70s, 80s visual artist, indicating his sort of frustration with how he was treated in the art world. So he said, "I am not a black artist, I am an artist." It's a very sort of famous quote now. And it's a quote that actor, singer, songwriter Zoe Kravitz is responding to in the one up on the slide, saying, "Happy to be black, just don't need to say it in front of everything." So the way that Kravitz is framing this complaint seems to be quite like a subtle one to do with ordering, not saying that you don't want somebody to attend to your race, it's just that, you know, don't attend to it all the time, and that makes it salient in every context. This sort of complaint, I think, comes up in lots of other anecdotes and testimonies that I've been looking at. So, for instance, testimonies from people who are sort of racially marginalized individuals in the field of STEM. One participant in a study on the subject saying, "My belief is that I am seen as a black person first." Similar issues raised by those who are marginalized in terms of their gender. So women, for instance, regularly object to being seen first and foremost as a woman, say, versus like a scientist or an engineer or whatever it might be. So one blog by an anonymous philosopher discusses her concerns about being seen primarily as a woman. She says, "You know, you women philosophers will always end up philosophically on the subject of your gender simply because you will be seen as a woman first and a philosopher second." Philosophers Rebecca Buxton and Lisa Whiting, authors of Philosopher Queens, also comment on this type of a concern. So they reflect on the association between philosophy and maleness, and say that, quote, a result of this is that women are often remembered as women first. They are seen more as women than they're seen as philosophers. We forget that they are principally philosophers. There's lots of other anecdotes that I could draw on. But I guess what I'm kind of wanting to suggest here is that I want to suggest that something to do with attentional salience might be one way of interpreting the claims here, insofar as people are resisting having their marginalized social identity, whether that's their race or gender or whatever, being made to be the most salient feature in the attention of others. And I think, I don't want you to think that I'm suggesting that's the only way to understand those testimonies. There's a load of different ways we might try and understand them, including like being categorized wrongly as a Black philosopher, as opposed to just a philosopher. I'm trying, at least in this work, I was trying to pick up on a subtle end of a general phenomenon that maybe reflects a distinctively subtle phenomenology where you feel like there's the wrong emphasis is placed on your traits. Not that you're like necessarily wrongly categorized, but there's just the weird thing with emphasis going on. Now, to get a more precise diagnosis, I then drew on tools in the philosophy of attention. Could go into more detail about the nature of attention here, but it's not actually, I don't think, totally necessary for this talk. So I'm just going to flag that attention is something that I, at least in the way that I'm understanding it, especially through people like Sebastian Wotzel, it's a selective affair about prioritizing in your conscious experience some things over other things. And also attention is something that sort of cross-cuts the standard divisions of the mind insofar as it might be perceptual attention, it could be metacognitive attention. It's about your mental, like prioritizing your mental states in a selective way where those mental states might be perceptual, they might be metacognitive, they might be cognitive and so on. As I see it, many ways, maybe all ways, not sure, of evaluating attention involve evaluating the manner of attending to certain contents. So the contents of our attention, there's loads of them, potentially, right? But the ones that are most relevant to this talk, at least, are the ones up on the slide. So I might focus on like a property of yours, which we might spell out in various ways, like your body or your race or whatever it might be. Or I might focus on you as a person in comparison to, say, your friend, the person sat next to you. Or I might focus on a group of people, say, women versus another social group like men. So that's just one way of like spelling out now. We're going to come back to that. That's why that's there. But that's one way of spelling out the contents of attention, but then how to spell out the other side of the analysis, right? The manner of attention on certain contents. Again, I don't want to be too long on this, but all I want to suggest is, like, I guess that the flowchart that I'm about to put up on the slide is a way of driving home that attention can come in different forms of gradedness. So, you know, I might focus too much on the wrong trait, like your speech impediment in a conversation with you. That might come with a deficit of attention on the content of what you're saying, say. That can well occur in quite extreme ways. So I might only fixate on your speech impediment, and that comes with a total deficit insofar as I ignore totally the words, the content of what you're saying. Or of course there's going to be more subtle variations on this, such that I am paying attention to what you're saying. I can tell you about what you said afterwards. It's just that those things weren't as selectively prioritized in my attention as your speech impediment. There's just, like, again, an incorrect emphasis going on. So I think that kind of taxonomy can give us a bit more of a precise diagnosis about what's going on with the testimonies at the beginning. So essentially, I think the individuals can be understood as objecting to the manner in which others attend to certain contents, the contents being their race or gender or whatever, or their identity as a philosopher. And these properties, at least the properties to do with their marginalized status, being Black or being a woman, these are given a relative attentional surplus. There's too much attention, but maybe not such that people are fixating, and maybe people are still acknowledging they're paying attention to their interests and passions and whatever, just that they're not given the right level of attention. There's different ways that we might spell out what's going wrong here. Jess has put this out as a stream before, so I'm just copying that because it's really nice and handy. Ultimately, we might suggest that the attentional pattern goes wrong because of something upstream to it. It's caused by an irrational attitude or whatever it might be. It might go wrong because of something downstream to it, something that it causes. Maybe you noticing me focusing too much on your impediment causes you to withdraw from social situations. Or we might try and do the slightly more interesting thing, I think, and suggest that the attentional pattern itself is problematic in some way. And that's something that I've tried to focus on before, as have others, including sort of Jesse Munton, Georgie Gardner, and others. Again, this isn't key, but just to flag them here, a couple of ways that I've tried to suggest elsewhere is that certain attentional patterns might be an aspect of respecting or disrespecting the personhood of the attendee. And I also think that maybe attentional patterns, when we're comparing the attentional pattern on one group versus another, we might suggest that they are aspects of what it is to be equal, like relationally speaking. So maybe part of unequal consideration, attentional patterns may be part of unequal consideration, might be another way of going. Okay. Now, what I do kind of want to focus on a little bit more here is, you know, the types of salience that we might be able to unpack from what we've just been hearing about a little bit. So I think the attentional patterns draw out different notions of what sort of salience refers to, and we can see them best, I think, through just at least using some sort of objection, first of all. The individuals, I guess, described as marginalized in the domain so far, one thing that they do not do is represent the statistical or normative norm for their domain. So take women in philosophy. Women aren't statistically the norm, right? Because there's fewer of them in our discipline, so they're just outnumbered. But also, and in terms of like, you know, books and whatever, philosophy books and so on. But we might also suggest that women don't fit like the normative norm for philosophers, insofar as they don't represent maybe the social stereotype of what a philosopher is, the natural or ideal philosopher in our sort of, you know, consciousness. Now, this kind of results in some ways in the privileged people, right, being salience. So to Jesse, for instance, talks about how, you know, a salience structure, in her words, is in part determined by thoroughly mundane facts about the organization of the subject's environment. So if there are fewer books about Black film directors, or if those books are only available in specialist bookshops, then that information is less accessible to the subject than the information about white film directors, right? That's the suggestion that she has. So this means, right, that it's the white film directors who are accessible in a very important sense. They're the ones who, you know, people who are making books on the subject, people who are, you know, inviting people to talks on the subject are going to think of first. So in the philosophy context, we might suggest that when lecturers, say, are coming up with who to include in their syllabi, it's the men that crop up to them first. They're the things that are sort of salient in their attention in that sense. Now, critically, this results in some pretty problematic attentional deficits for the marginalized individuals. So referring to another vector of marginalization, class, Leonie Smith and Alfred Archer comment on research that teachers kind of ignore working class students in a classroom, in part because they're not like the ones who are stereotypically associated with knowledge domains that they're existing in. So it's the middle class students who are leaping out to the teachers, especially when they're sort of like focusing on students in the classroom. And instead, the working class students end up receding into the background. They're the ones who aren't paid enough attention. Okay. So the objection, to spell it out a bit more explicitly, is that I seem to be getting things the wrong way around a little bit. I'm suggesting that less attention be paid to marginalized individuals, but they're attention deprived. They need more attention. So my solution is to kind of return to the taxonomy from earlier, and to distinguish at least firstly different contents of attention that I think help to spell out what's going on. So, you know, the privileged individuals described may well be more salient than the marginalized individuals qua individual and qua group, but they don't generally have their like whiteness or their manness or whatever made salient, their demographic properties. So we're not really used to thinking about their identity as a man, is part of my suggestion. This is something I'm going to return to later. And by contrast, the marginalized individuals, they do indeed suffer attentional deficits qua individual and qua group. But what is made really, really salient is their demographic property. So they're like their race, their gender, and so on. You know, so I guess when we're thinking about our philosophy syllabi, Black philosophers, white philosophers, women philosophers, women philosophers tend not to be salient, leading to them be much less likely to be included in the syllabi in the first place. But when we do engage with Black philosophers, we, in various contexts, their race is liable to stand out to us and sort of jump out to us. These kind of help us to spell out, I think, different notions of salience. So the philosophers who are white, who are men and so on, are accessible salient due to being the sort of statistical normative implicit norm for the domain. That means that as individuals and as a group, they're cognitively accessible when we're thinking about philosophy and philosophers. So this is kind of to suggest that they're at the top of the head, so to speak. This kind of salience, I guess, is about a disposition or readiness to attend because of the accessibility relations in one's cognition. Generally, I think this isn't always the case, but I think we're not always very phenomenologically aware of this type of salience. We're not aware of this occurring, that we're finding these things so accessible. But by contrast, I think the philosophers who are, say, women, who are Black, are salient in a different sense. Their demographic properties are like striking to us in those domains. So this is to say that those properties grab or pierce our attention. And that's in part because of things like the statistical signal to noise ratio that we're seeing, but also in virtue of them contravening normative norms in our mind too. Now, this kind of salience, I think, generally comes with a bit more of a determinate phenomenological profile, a bit like how a bright light on a dark street or something, we're going to feel our attention pulled that way. And I think similar things can be said for this context too. So maybe there's a bit more of a grasp of our attention being pulled, unlike the other kind of attention. Ultimately, I think that distinguishing the different contents of attention, as well as the different types of salience associated with each of those scenarios, is one way to kind of resolve what was the initial objection that we had, because the marginalized individuals do need for their demographic properties to become less striking salient, while needing to be more accessible salient for the domain as individuals and as a group. And I think that this demonstrates quite neatly how an attentional surplus on your demographic properties is very much has a non-arbitrary connection to the attentional deficits that you suffer qua individual and qua group. Okay, something to flag, and this is something that I'll be like drawing on a little bit in what follows quite solidly, is the sort of relative advantages versus disadvantages associated with each type of sort of salience here. So I don't think it's particularly surprising to notice that, you know, being accessible salient in these domains in the context that we're talking about can be pretty advantageous for you. So it can help you to feel like a sense of belonging, I think, that you just are, you know, you're the first person that somebody thinks of when they're thinking about philosophers to include, say, in their syllabi. And it's also, so it helps your sense of belonging, it helps your confidence, it helps your research being taken more seriously, you know, how others see you, how probably students see you, hence teaching evaluation issues and so on. And by contrast, the way in which women, say womanness, the demographic, you know, property of womanness is striking salience generally comes with quite important disadvantages. So that's the idea that it reinforces the idea that the womanness aspect is like exotic or deviant in certain ways. So philosopher George Yancey describes his experience of like moving in and out of APA conferences and so on, spaces like that. And he talks about being, quote, Black within such monochromatic white spaces, how it feels existentially to be an inappropriate subject situated within a sea of white faces. Well, Yancey here, right, is capturing how this like signal to noise ratio is commonly processed, bringing with it sort of attitudes of othering, and sort of judgments that you're deviant in some way in that domain. And like Helen Beebe is also somebody who's described this sort of a thing when it comes to the specific case study of women in philosophy. Got a paper on like how atypicality in this context tends to get processed as deviance. Of course, this can hurt your sense of belonging and confidence, right, in the discipline. And it's no secret that these things will impact, no doubt, things like teaching evaluations and how others more generally in the profession see you and treat you. All right, so I've now sketched some issues relating to salience with regarding to being, you know, marginalized in the workplace. So let's move to my sort of case study response to this kind of an issue. Fortunately, there's a load of really important, impactful activism that is seeking to respond to the sort of issues that I've mentioned. And these have done a load of good, continue to do an awful lot of good. As I'll mention in a moment, the intention of this is not to just, you know, sort of suggest that these are terrible things in any way, shape or form. I think they're great. But I want to focus on one particular kind of strategy aspect of some of these initiatives that I think doesn't need to be the way that it is. Now, this is when these initiatives kind of explicitly draw attention to the marginalized identity that they are seeking to benefit. And that's usually through things like their headline communication. So the name of the group, Women in Philosophy, or as I'm going to pick up, various books called things like Women Philosophers or The Philosopher Queens and so on. So this is a strategy where like womanness is quite explicitly signaled, right? Again, just flags this. I do not want to just undermine what these groups do. I want to hammer that point home. I am still part of these groups often. I've been part a lot in the past as well. I also very obviously benefit hugely from them, not least in a very obvious way of being able to create this talk. The like data at the start of this, that like, you know, the Women in Philosophy testimonies I got were from forums online that were created through these initiatives. I benefit massively from these things. However, I don't want that benefit to stop us from discussing the best strategies for these things. So I want this to be read, if you can, in the most charitable way possibly. I'm coming at this with good faith, I believe. You may disagree, but that's what I'd like to say. Also, I'd like to sort of flag that there's loads of things that these initiatives and these strategies are trying to do, right? Beyond just trying to overcome the sorts of issues I mentioned in the first place. So that might be creating sort of spaces of solidarity and so on. And I'm suggesting that when we're trying to make our judgment about what the best thing to do is for these strategies, for these initiatives, sorry, we should at least just factor in the concern that I want to raise today. Not that it should dominate us and like therefore we decide to change everything on the basis of what I'm talking about. God knows, just let's think about it a bit, and because it might change some of our strategies. However, where we're in the business of looking for potential issues with these strategies and these initiatives, there's other things that we could raise that we could talk about, right? So one might be how some of these groups end up sort of making maybe non-binary gender identities invisible, issues to do with intersectionality, of focusing on one kind of vector of discrimination at the expense of a lot of others, often ones that require more focus, actually. So I guess that's also to flag when we are in a bit more of a critical mindset, we might come up with other issues. I'm just focusing on this one issue. Okay, to bring some shape to this worry, I'd like to start with a bit of an anecdote. So I mentioned the wonderful book, The Philosopher Queens, earlier. So that's Rebecca Buxton and Lisa Whiting's book. And that is something that sort of captures outstanding contributions from women philosophers over time in the hope of sort of better representing women in the discipline, changing common perceptions of philosophy, who counts as a philosopher. The book's had some really, really important successes that are not trivial. So that includes anecdotes from both Rebecca Buxton, well, mainly Rebecca Buxton, because she's still in academic philosophy, but undergrads have come up to them and said, I am studying philosophy because of that book. I picked up that book and now I'm studying philosophy. That's amazing and that's huge. So please keep that in mind. But they themselves have this really nice anecdote when they're reflecting on their book that I want to sort of focus on. So they talk initially about the reason that they wrote the book in the first place. And that was they went into their local bookshop, and you might be able to guess, there's just like absolutely nothing on women philosophers. There's like, you look at the greatest books about philosophers and like there's no women in, maybe like de Beauvoir gets a shout out, and that's essentially it. Like that's, it was a very depressing trip to the local bookshop. So they take on the task of contributing to a small literature of, trying to reclaim women in philosophy, highlighting the work of philosophers, all of them women, it's a book created by two women, all that sort of stuff. You might be able to see the kicker coming here, but in their words, quote, so in late 2020, when our book was finally out in the world, we went back to the same bookshop to find that our book on great philosophers throughout history had been put in the section on women and gender studies. This happened apparently across bookshops throughout the UK, most large high street chains putting Philosopher Queens in the women or gender studies section. So they say, the Philosopher Queens, trying to talk about history's greatest philosophers was seen first through the lens of women's issues rather than philosophical ones. There's another example, but for time reasons, we can come back to it if we want to, but I'm just going to move on. I think that's enough for now. So, what's going on? Well, the hypothesis that I'm going to try and defend in what follows is one of the long-term ambitions of these initiatives is to, I think, get rid of some of the salience patterns and the worries associated with them that I described in section one and two of the talk. But in order to achieve this aim, many replicate that salience pattern by making women's gender especially salient. So like to fix issues to do with women, you mentioned women, you call it women in philosophy, you call it philosopher queens, that's the strategy. This is a problem, largely for the reasons I think articulated in section one and two, specifically one end that inadvertently entrenching the very kind of salience pattern to that one objects to, and the dominant way that that pattern tends to get integrated into the social imagination. And that is where, you know, like womanness is considered like exotic and deviant and so on. Okay. So that's the case study, the initial gloss of the problem. Here's maybe the argument, which you probably are waiting for. So to get us started on that, consider maybe quite a natural, initial response you might have to that initial gloss. So yes, of course, both kind of make womanness salient in a sense. But this salience pattern just has a very different functional profile when it's adopted very uncritically in a workplace. Yes, there it leads to exoticization and deviance judgments versus in an egalitarian initiative. There, highlighting womanness is a way of highlighting gender-based injustices, of signaling opportunities for solidarity and so on. Now, like, I do think this definitely gets something right, but I don't think it tells us the whole story. Why do I think this? Well, I want us to start by considering a problem with certain forms of counter-speech. So that's the method of combating false or harmful views, speech with more speech. Right, okay. So Maxime Lepoutre is somebody who has drawn quite heavily on some really interesting philosophers of language from Mary-Kate McGowan, Robert Simpson, Jason Stanley, who suggests that things like conspiracy theories and hate speech have this quite like special quality, which Lepoutre identifies as enduring salience, which results in them posing like a problem for counter speech, a very distinctive problem for counter speech. So what's this kind of like special quality? Well, conspiracy theories and the views expressed through hate speech are, in Lepoutre's words, quote, inherently disposed to capture and retain our attention. They easily become salient to us. And when this has happened, it is difficult to make them less salient. So things like conspiracy theories that COVID-19 vaccines are a big pharma scam, climate change is a hoax, or, you know, hate speech views like immigrant X are parasites, immigrant group X are parasites. These are claims that have real kind of like persisting salience in the senses just mentioned. So for various reasons, like the regular repetition of them in our media, but also their simplicity, their like emotional charge, their coherence with many other things that we're told and hear. They really like retain our attention. Now, what's wrong with countering these things through conventional forms of counter speech? Well, Lepoutre suggests that counter speech often involves repeating the speech in service of debunking it. So saying COVID-19 pandemic was not orchestrated by pharmaceutical companies, which was a Reuters 21 headline as an example, or saying, oh, but immigrant group X aren't parasites. They contribute a huge amount to the economy. The idea, again, drawing on a lot of work in the philosophy of language, is that this kind of counter speech can be counterproductive insofar as it ends up strengthening the very view that it's attacking. So as Robert Simpson says, rejecting an association of ideas may inadvertently make one's interlocutors pay even more attention to it, an association that functions to attract and retain our attention anyway, end quote. So making that association, proposition, or whatever it is, unsalient again is really hard. And that's behind the phrase that no doubt many of us in the room have heard before of Mary-Kate McGowan's, that it's as futile as trying to unring a bell. Now, Lepoutre ends up calling this like negative counter speech to reflect the strategy of repeating the problematic proposition in service of debunking it. And he then goes on to offer more other forms of counter speech that avoid this positive counter speech. But that, I'm not going to focus on that right now. Instead, I want to have a quick look at the kinds of problems that Laputra identifies emerging from all of this. So one is that attention is limited. The fact that something is being made salient in the public arena is one way of trying to communicate the idea that it's worth paying attention to. We should direct our sort of attention resources that way. This also deflects attention from other stuff. So it deflects attention, I guess, from, you know, ways in which immigrant groups contribute to the economy, or like they suffer great things, or ways in which, you know, the real human and financial cost of the pandemic, to take the other example that we had. And he also thinks, and this is the thing that I'm going to home in a little bit more in what follows, once salient, these views then feel familiar to us. And quite an unfortunate, in this case, feature of our human psychology is that gradually things that become familiar to us are interpreted as true as time goes on, which seems like a problem, right, for Laputra. So he thinks that this makes negative counter-speech particularly ineffective, or worse, counterproductive. Okay, my suggestion is that the tendency to treat women as women first in philosophy, so to give women's gender such an attentional surplus, this is a salient structure that is kind of like easy to put on and hard to shake off. It's quite sticky, so to speak. And that's because it's kind of reinforced in the world in which we live in. It stands out in part due to its high signal to noise ratio, the stereotypes that we encounter in the discipline. And I also think that whilst this is meaningfully different to Laputra's case, because we're not saying women aren't women first, you know, instead we're just saying women and philosophy, so there's a difference there. But I still think that there's a repetition of the salient structure that associates womanness with philosophy, or in a way that makes it explicit, makes womanness explicit. And in that sense, I think it has a parallel with counter-speech. Now, this makes that salient structure, I think, feel familiar. We're now become used to associating womanness with philosophy. Again, notice how we don't talk about menness in philosophy. We don't talk about men in philosophy. That's just not something we really talk about. And so the suggestion is that that sediments the striking salience of womanness in this context. And whilst we can't necessarily say that that therefore makes it feel true, because this is a non-propositional thing, a salient structure, we might say that it makes that salient structure feel apt. It feels appropriate to attend so much to women's gender in this context. Okay, so I'm going to try and sort of defend that in what follows. There we go. Little picture exemplifying this. Right. But the way that I'm going to do it is first suggest that things are worse than this. Okay. I think that making womanness striking salient in the context of philosophy can also trigger the dominant aspects of the social imagination that are associated with that salience pattern. And namely, that's the kind of stuff in section two that I mentioned, where womanness is considered exotic and deviant. Why do I think that? Onto the zombie part of the talk. Every good talk has one of them. So to make this a little bit more plausible, I want to draw on some nice sort of work in sort of the philosophy of language processing. So Eugene Fischer and Justin Sitzmer have studied polysemous word processing. So that's like how we process words with different senses. And they talk about like philosophers, as one example of this, using the word zombie in philosophical thought experiments to invoke like quite an irregular technical term, right, of the sense of zombie, things that behave like you and me, have bodies like ours, but lack conscious experience. That's different, right, to the Hollywood use of the term. So that includes other features like attacks and kills and eats humans and has a rotting body, stuff that the philosophy term isn't really about. Now, despite the sort of philosophy usage explicitly cancelling a bunch of those associations, Fischer and Sitzmer find that philosophers hearing about philosophical zombies were much more inclined to attribute typical zombie features to the imagined beings from rotting bodies and the desire to eat you than they were when asked to imagine mere duplicates, a term without that kind of baggage. This is because the much more dominant sense of the term zombie essentially is much more familiar to us, and it is repeated much more regularly, so it's got this kind of enduring salience. And ultimately they suggest that this compromises the reliability, right, of philosophers' intuitions about the conceivability of zombies, because all of this is messing up our intuitions. that bit isn't my focus. Instead, my focus is their conclusion from these studies, which is, quote, when the dominant sense of an irregular polyseme, so a polyseme with like different senses, but where one is weighted more heavily is more dominant, is far more salient than its other senses, the features strongly associated with the dominant sense will be strongly activated by the verbal stimulus regardless of context. This means that the subordinate sense won't succeed in being communicated because, quote, contextually cancelled stereotypical inferences supported by the dominant sense will be triggered by the subordinate sense as well. Okay. So they therefore conclude that, quote, thinkers are liable to be swept along by the stereotypical dominant inferences, even when these are defeated by context. And further, this is a case of activation of these stereotypical features that isn't then blocked as irrelevant. They say these automatic inferences will influence further judgment and reasoning, hence why it gets baked into philosophers' intuitions about conceivability of zombies. But the point here is that we can draw on a lot of work on, like, say, stereotype activation that's unconscious, because that tends to be much more effective than activating a stereotype explicitly, because it prevents you from blocking at any inferences that you might, if you were conscious of them being activated, block. So it has real strength, this sort of unconscious, under the radar stereotype activation. Okay. My hypothesis is that this also applies to salient structures. So women in philosophy initiatives are trying to make womanness salient in a way that draws attention to injustice and opportunities for solidarity and so on. And despite that being the intended and quite obvious sense in which it's intended, it's liable to activate its dominant sense, namely womanness as exotic and deviant. And again, this is so even though it's made incredibly clear by the context that that wouldn't be appropriate. Okay. So far, though, we've looked at research into things like words with different senses associated with them. So why think this stuff could apply to salience patterns? That's something I'm going to try and, you know, because I'm talking here about women in philosophy as opposed to a particular kind of word, say, I guess womanness is part of it. But let's try and think about how this might apply to salience patterns a bit more robustly. Okay. In other work, something that I've tried to do is look at ways of making things salient in language in our communication. I've focused on order primarily. Others have focused on things like mentioning, how just simply mentioning something can make something salient in language. But I've looked therefore at order effects to sort of substantiate the claims I want to make about the mechanism of order salience. So order effects are things that occur when the order in which logically equivalent information is communicated to an audience like makes a difference to that audience interpretation when it, logically speaking, it seems like it shouldn't. So take psychologist Celine Kessevier's research, who has investigated order effects in relation to gender biases. Some really interesting research there. Kessevier focused on how saying men and women do X or whatever, instead of women and men do X across various kind of propositions, results in audiences being more likely to infer and endorse gender stereotypes. That simple flipping around of those words. And this happens because discussing men before women invokes a linguistic norm that the content discussed first, is more central or relevant to the topic at hand. This is sort of known as the primacy effect. And that general linguistic norm in turn sort of unconsciously activates a range of features in the social imagination that help us to make sense of why that thing was signaled as more relevant and more salient. So when we're trying to unpick, again, unconsciously, why men have been signaled to be more relevant because they've been mentioned first, well, don't worry, our social imagination has totally got you back on this. There's a really large web, right, of stereotypes and ideologies and beliefs that support this general notion that men are indeed more salient and relevant in our lives. So that might be stereotypes relating to things like agency and power, right? Men are stereotyped to be assertive, decisive, rational, among many other traits, which can then be sort of marshaled to explain and justify the increased focus on them, why they've been made salient. Feminine stereotypes generally function to rationalize women's more kind of peripheral social positions, like, you know, traits of passivity and nurturance and so on, sort of situate them as more like background characters, supporting men's more influential role. So I guess the lesson from this research is that simply making men more salient than women in language by mentioning them first can trigger gender stereotypes in audiences' minds, because when something's been made salient to us, we unconsciously draw on various aspects of the social imagination that help to explain why it's been made salient. And that can involve gender stereotypes and so on, if that's the context of the proposition or whatever it is. Okay. And ultimately, this is something that I think we can apply to the topic at hand, right? That making womanness salient in the context of philosophy can trigger background biases that help us to make sense of why women have been made, or womanness has been made salient in this context. And I think that prominent social biases like, well, womanness is like exotic and deviant, is one way of like making sense of that, of the signals relevance of womanness in the context of philosophy. So there's a few sort of takeaways from this that I want to focus on. One, I think, is that salience patterns can activate inferences to cognitively accessible and socially licensed biases that resonate with them. When a salience pattern is strongly associated with a specific set of inferences, insofar as there's like a dominant bundle of sort of stereotypes and beliefs and so on associated with that salience structure, salience pattern, an attempt to use that salience pattern to facilitate alternative inferences will be unlikely to succeed. The more strongly associated set is liable to be activated even when those inferences are cancelled by the context, the new context, much like it was for the research that I've been drawing on. These findings suggest that the problem is worse, really, than what Laputra's analysis finds. So when countering a problematic view or bias or whatever it might be that has enduring salience, it's not just like repeating the view that can sort of counterproductively entrench it. Simply repeating the salient structure that is integral to that view can be sufficient counterproductively to entrench that view. So return with this in mind to the sort of example that we had. Well, Buxton and Whiting say in their reflections on the book, you know, our book even had the word philosopher in the title, and yet it was placed where the women are kept. And I get that frustration totally, like it just feels incredibly annoying, but I kind of feel like I can understand why it, not why, like I don't think it's a good thing that it happened, but I can understand the mechanism that led to the book being placed where it was. So I think ultimately, the book makes womanness strikingly salient in the context of philosophy by saying philosopher queens. We're all of a sudden thinking about womanness in the context of philosophy. And ultimately, that involves reiterating a salient structure that we're quite used to in the world more generally, making it feel quite familiar and therefore maybe likely to be interpreted as apt, that it's right for us to direct so much of our attention to womanness in the context of philosophy. In their book, the reason it makes it strikingly salient, I think, is because it's catching the eye in the title and therefore sort of triggering these things. Now, once this has happened, I think our minds then draw on background associations, beliefs, and ideologies to make sense of why womanness has been made salient. And as part of that, ideas that womanness is exotic or deviant gets triggered in this process. And that happens even when we're in a context where it's like so incredibly clear that that's a really silly set of associations to have activated in your mind. That's just the way I think that our psychology works. So I guess what I want to suggest is that like the reason it ends up in this section is in part because we've triggered this salience structure and its associated biases that sort of swim around it in our social imagination, where womanness is indeed her most striking feature. So better pop it in the gender section because that takes care of that. And frustratingly, I think it makes it harder to place it in the philosophy section, because the title has now activated also various aspects of the social imagination that render womanness exotic or deviant. So it feels even weirder putting it in the philosophy books. We've just had all of those associations activated too, where like, oh, women aren't proper philosophers or they're not ideal philosophers. Okay, so I'm going to mention Okay, time is, I'm up against time. So I'm only going to mention a couple here, but I want to just spell out, and this is fine, I think, for Q&A to maybe talk about this in a bit more depth. I think that, you know, when we're trying to figure out how to lessen the chance of triggering these regressive aspects in social imagination and work to kind of fix things, expand our social imagination in progressive ways, we should probably bear in mind that there's different salience-based goals that we might have, and they're influenced by what we discussed in sort of section two of the talk in particular. So one is about making womanness as a demographic property less striking salient in the context of philosophy or being a philosopher. That's, I guess, the main takeaway of the talk. Of course, another is making women as a group, as individuals, more salient in the sense of implicit norm. One is making, this is something I want to linger on in a moment, making like the masculine gender a more strikingly salient thing, where it becomes sort of a topic for scrutiny and it you know, is all of a sudden more open to us, whilst also making men as individuals and as a group less accessible salient in the context of philosophy. These can sometimes overlap in mutually reinforcing ways, but the whole point of this talk has been to suggest that they can sometimes conflict unless we think about how to make them work together. So what do we do in terms of this first one? I think like there's various potential solutions, none of which I am wedded to, and I need to think about this a lot more. I'd be really curious to hear what people think. It could be naming the problem or the solution itself, so inequalities being the problem, or inclusion in philosophy that take us away from the actual demographic identity itself. Again, when we're thinking about these solutions, we need to be really mindful of the various goals that we have in these groups, right? Because we need to weigh those up against each other, such as providing a clear and unambiguous safe space for women. And also this can, you know, I guess one thing to home in on here is that that doesn't always fix things either, because of course terms can become coded over time. So talking about inequalities in philosophy probably makes us all think of women or Black people and so on. So maybe that doesn't solve things, but it might help in certain ways. I will skip over this, but yes, there's some suggestions about how to make women as a group, you know, more salient in the sense of implicit norm. Now, this is the one that I kind of want to focus on, and the reason for it, and I'll literally just do this in sort of 30 seconds now, is that I guess one response you might have to me at this stage is, are you advocating therefore for some like weird gender-blind approach to fixing inequalities in philosophy? Like, no, I think that objection assumes that if we are to avoid gender-blind approaches, we need to make the marginalized identity salient. That's unfair. Why can't we also make the privileged identity salient in a way that makes them this object of critical scrutiny, subject of critical scrutiny? So George Yancey, somebody who's got a really nice kind of set of suggestions about how he engages in these like Socratic dialogues with his students and gets them to start to tease out how a lot of the interests and concerns that they have, that they pitch in their head as just like, everyone's interested in these are just objectively interesting aspects of philosophy, actually have connections to whiteness, both in terms of their historical valuation, but also their interests as, and like their social positioning as white people who are allowed to think about these concerns. There's some really, really interesting work there actually that I'd like to talk about more. But there's also like, you know, others who pick up on this. So I think it's classicist, where is this? Sorry. Here we go. Sorry. Yeah, classicist Emily Wilson is somebody who sort of echoes Yancey's feelings here. So Wilson, who's in her book Translating the Odyssey, says, men have gender identities as well. And I think that it's a problem that we never seem to know that or ask them about it, which I thought was quite a nice way of putting this. Anyway, much more that I could say here, but I realize for time reasons, it's probably wise to just get to this conclusion. So part of the aim of egalitarian initiatives like Women in Philosophy, like books like Philosopher Queens and so on, is to overcome the profession's systematic tendency to see women as women first, philosophers second, where that kind of salient structure ends up positioning womanness as exotic and deviant. In combating these issues, elements of these strategies, like Women in Philosophy, replicate that salient structure that, and so also make womanness striking salient in the context of philosophy. You might think this isn't a problem because it's very clearly operating in a very different functional environment. It's leading to different things than in the uncritical use in the workplace. But I think because that salient structure is so dominantly so associated with that dominant sense of exoticization and deviance that these associations are likely to get triggered even in the subversive context. Thank you very, very much for listening.